We're holding on page 14 in Yoma Osiyo Dalet. We learned yesterday that says that the Truma Sadeshen, the taking off the ashes off the Mizbeach every morning was usually done around the time of Kroys HaGever, a little bit before, a little bit after Kroys HaGever. And we said we had a machlokas Rav and Reb Shila what Kroys HaGever means. Rav said that it means that there was an official in the Beis HaMikdash. Gever means a person. His job was to call out, as we're going to bring now a Braisa, his job was to call out and tell the Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim that it's time to go to their respective stations. So when he does that, would be called Kroys HaGever. Then we had Reb Shila said that Kroys HaGever means when the rooster crows, because Gever can also mean a rooster. So the Gemara says, Tanya Kava say the Rav. We learn a Braisa like the way Rav learns. The Braisa says, Gvini Koroys Mahu Omer. What would Gvini Koroys say? He was one of the officials in the Beis HaMikdash. His job was to make the announcements. So what would he say? Imdu Koinim Lavadaschem. So he would say, Kohanim, get up for your avoda. Or Levim leduchanchem. Levim, get up to go to the duchan where you're going to be singing and playing the musical instruments in the Beis HaMikdash. Yisrael ma'amadchem. Yisraelim, go to your maimed, where the Gemara tells us primarily in Tainis, you had groups of Jews. You had groups of Jews who would represent the rest of the Jewish people in being, some of them would actually be there in the Beis HaMikdash during the Avodah. Others would remain in their cities around Eretz Yisrael. All of them had special fasts and tefillos and kriyasin and kriyas from the Torah and so forth on behalf of the Jewish people. So he would be announcing that Yisraelim, come be there for your maimon. You could hear his voice three parsa away. Three parsa is around 8 or 9 miles. And in fact, it happened once that Agrippa Samalach was Mahalach Balaila, means he was traveling at night. Shababa Derech would just mean that he was traveling on the road. He actually heard Gvini Kores' announcements from three palaces away, and he was very impressed. When he got back home, when he got to his palace, he sent this Gvini a lot of presents because he was so impressed with his talent. He had very good vocal cords, I guess. Yeah. However, nevertheless, the Gemara points out that Afal Pi Ken Shel Kohen Gadol Meshubach Mimenu. On the other hand, though, the Kohen Gadol's ability to project his voice was even greater than Gvini Korez's. The Omer Mar, because we learn later on in the Masechta, Shahoya Omer, or Kvar Omer, Ona Hashem Chatosi, the Kohen Gadol, we know he would do vidui three times during the Avodah of Yom Kippur. The first one was, particularly, Rashi says he would do the vidui on his par, where he's saying for himself and his immediate family, Chatosi Avisi Pashaiti. So it once happened that he was saying, Ona Hashem Chatosi V'nishma Kole B'Yerichoi, and you could hear his voice all the way in Yerichoi, V'omer Rabba Labachana, Omer Rabbi Yechanan, how far is that? Mi'ushalayim L'Yerichoi Eser Parsois Havu. It was 10 parsa from Yerushalayim to Yericho. So that's a lot further than the three parsa that Gvini Koreis' voice carried. Now, it doesn't mean that this happened all the time. Rashi uses the expression, Pam achas hoya maisa, it happened one time. And the Ritva explains that what Rashi means is when the Jewish people were zoicha to it, then you had that ness that the Kohen Gadol's voice could be heard 10 parsa away, where 10 parsa is somewhere like 25 miles.
I was going to just ask you, can this be taken at face value, or it's a metaphor?
On the face of it, yes. On the face of it, yes. We do mean literally. Tosfos actually points out that there is elsewhere a Mishnah that says that Gvini Koros' voice could also be heard in Yerichoi. So in that case, what's the advantage of the Kohen Gadol over Gvini? So Tosfos says what it is in Yerichoi they could hear a noise. They couldn't identify the words, but they could hear a sound. Whereas with the Kohen Gadol's words, we're saying they could actually hear the words on Hashem in Yerichoi. On the other hand, Tosfos Yeshanim says that maybe not necessarily. It could be that the various Gemaras and Mishnayos on the subject are arguing on how far Gvini's voice could actually be heard. There is also an interesting explanation that one of the Mefoshim says. It doesn't mean that they could hear it in all the distance from Yerushalayim to Yerichoi, but rather there was something special about Yerichoi. Yericho was the first city the Jewish people conquered in Eretz Yisrael, and Yoshua declared it. It's cherem, it becomes like hektish, all of it has to be burned except for the treasures are going to have to go to the Beis Hamikdash. So therefore, it had a degree of Kedusha more than the other cities in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, it's almost like there was a pipeline between it and Yerushalayim, such that there are things that could be heard or experienced in Yericho that you wouldn't necessarily have on the road between Yerushalayim and there. So whatever the case, though, it was definitely some kind of mice in Nissim, because no matter how loud and powerful a person's voice is, the Bederach HaTeva, it's not going to project that far. And in fact, on top of that, the Gemara points out, V'afagav dehocha ikka cholsha, v'hocha leka cholsha. Now we consider, the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur is weak, because after all, he's fasting. And the Gvini Kores, when Agrippas heard him, was not fasting. The Pashto said it was a regular day. Marsha points out, after all, if Agrippas was traveling and it was three parsa away, it can't have been on Yom Tov or on Shabbos because he can't travel that far. So necessarily, therefore, it has to be that Gvini, well, that this one time when Agrippas heard Gvini was on a weekday. So he wasn't fasting. V'hocha yamama v'hocha leilya. Furthermore, Gvini's announcements are during the night, just around dawn, whereas the Kohen Gadol's announcements, where the Kohen Gadol's vidui is in the middle of the day. Nevertheless, the Kohen Gadol's voice projected further than Gvini's, showing, in other words, that the Kohen Gadol had an advantage over Gvini, that Gvini's voice could be heard, but the Kohen Gadol's voice could be heard still further and still clearer, and even under less favorable conditions. Now, what do we mean the difference between day and night? So the difference is like this. Why is it you don't hear the human voice as much by day? It doesn't travel as far by day as it does by night. The reason is because of the orb of the sun, the globe of the sun, which is soaring through the sky, like the way a carpenter saws through wood, the sun is constantly soaring through. Is constantly soaring through the heavens, and therefore it produces a noise. So therefore, by day, a person's voice would be drowned out by that, and therefore it doesn't carry as far. Whereas by night, you don't have, the sun is not in the sky, so therefore you don't have that noise, and therefore the sound can travel further. So radio, you have radio waves, you have all kinds of radiations from the sun, yeah? And the Gemara continues, as a matter of fact, they actually have specifically, as far as radio waves actually found, they travel further by night because there are layers of the atmosphere that block it or that weaken it or whatever by day, which are those layers change in composition by night, and therefore radio waves can travel further. Yeah, so that may be what the Gemara is referring to over here. Yeah. Anyway, now you have, when you look at a bright beam of sunlight, you'll see dust particles floating around in it. Those dust particles are actually caused, the Gemara is saying, by the sun, that the sun is soaring through the sky. So when you saw it, produces sawdust. So therefore, that's the dust that you see in a bright light. That chir gadiyoma lo shmei. The actual, it has a name. That stuff is called lo, which literally means nothing. So you can actually see it in a bright light. Thus we understand when Nebuchadnezzar says, after the whole story with he had his dream where he saw a big tree, and then the tree is chopped down and tied up with chains, and Daniel explains to him it means that you're going to go crazy and you're going to live among the animals for several years until you realize that Hashem is boss of the world. So after all that happens, and after Nebuchadnezzar goes back to normal, he writes an open letter to everybody in his kingdom, saying, now I realize the power of Hashem, how he controls everything. And he said, he uses the expression, b'chol doirei ara k'lo chashivim. Everybody who lives in the world is like law. Now, the simple meaning of law means nothing. In other words, that everybody in the world, everybody and everything in the world is like nothing compared to Hashem. But here the Gemara is explaining it somewhat differently, that the word law is this substance, this dust, these dust particles that you find floating around. So Nebuchadnezzar is saying that the whole, everything, everybody and everything in the world is like that law compared to the greatness of Hashem. One point is because chashivin suggests that there's a certain chashivos that you can count them. Law, if law actually means nothingness and nullity, then you can't talk about chashivin. So therefore, that's what makes the Gemara understand that we're talking about over here an actual substance, just a very insubstantial substance. So that's the stuff that we refer to. It actually has a name, and we can talk about what it is. And Marsha actually points out an interesting thing in Nedarim. This Gemara is also brought in Nedarim in a different context. Marsha says, when you think about it, he says, what causes heat is friction. So you have to be talking, that's why we're talking about over here, about the friction of the sun traveling through space, and that creates heat, which then comes to us. So in other words, the sun in and of itself, he says, wouldn't actually produce heat for us. It's only its movement that produces heat, because that's what heat is molecules vibrating. And therefore, so that's what comes to us as heat. So that, therefore, the Gemara talks about it in terms of the sun soaring through space.
Can you tie in this name Lo with Hashem's name Kel, the same Gematria 31?
Maybe there is some connection, but if there is, I haven't come across anything related to it, but I don't know. Could be. Okay. So Tana Rabbanan, so we learn in a Braisa in this connection. If it weren't for the noise of the sun's motion, like we just said, Nishma Kol Hamona Shel Roim, then we would hear the noise of the crowds of Rome. Rome being the Pashtus, we mean Pashtus, the city of Rome, all the noisy crowds of hundreds of thousands of people who are there, and the Roman Empire in general. So the one kind of drowns out the other. And vice versa, if it weren't for the noise of the crowds of Rome, you would actually be able to hear the noise of the sun's movement. So what does this symbolize? So Marsha says it means like this. We know that we Jewish people, we count our months according to the moon, and for that reason we're compared to the moon. The Goyim count their months, count their years according to the sun, and they're compared to the sun. We had earlier this concept about at the end of Pesachim about the 365 marketplaces in Rome, each one with 365 towers. Marshall made the same point over there that corresponds to the Shana Sacham. So now the sun is in the sky only by day. The same way the Goyim have, every Goyish nation has a period of dominance. They're like the sun, but then eventually they go into eclipse and they disappear, just like the sun sets. Just like the sun sets, as opposed to we Jewish people are like the moon, which constantly renews itself. And also the moon you see sometimes in the sky, both by day and by night. So therefore we're always there. So now we're saying, we see the Galgochama. So we see the sun is so big and powerful in the sky, and yet we see that eventually it sinks below the horizon and it goes away. If it weren't for that, then we would think that Chas V'Shalom, Hamona Shoroimi is going to last forever. When we see that the sun sets on a daily cycle, that tells us the same way Hamona Shoroimi will eventually cease to exist. And vice versa then. And then vice versa. If it weren't for Kol Hamona Shoroibi, then we would think that the sun is so powerful, we would think that's a god or something, Chas V'Shalom. But now that we see that even that people, they may have a tremendous empire like the way the Romans did, but we understand that it's all controlled by Hashem, and therefore we understand so is the sun. So they sort of fit together in that sense. But in a somewhat similar vein, the Sefer HaKedah explains that the Kol Galgochama refers to the fact that we look at the sun, we look at its daily motion and how it gives light and heat and earth to and everything to the earth, and we realize from that the greatness of Hashem. So he understands all Gemara not to necessarily literally be that it makes a sound, but rather we're talking about the effect of it. The effect, when you see the sun, it helps you realize the greatness of Hashem. And from that, it helps you realize that even the Hamona Shoroimi, similar to what Marsha is saying, is something that's also controlled by Hashem, and Hashem will decide when it's going to be over. The Maharal talks about it on a different level. He says that when we talk about this, what he says is each one of them, if you had any one of them by itself, than it would be, in other words, so you have only that kind of thing that would make it unique, and that would make it that it'll last forever, basically. But because you have two things that sort of cancel each other out, therefore it needs to begin with, even now, neither one of them has total dominance. The sun dominates the sky every day, but then sets. The Romans dominate the world for a period of time, but eventually they disappear. If you only had one and not the other, then it would mean that one is going to last forever. But like this, it's not like that. Continues the Gemara, Tana Rabbanan, Shloisha Kolon Holach Misofa Olamad Sofa. There are three things where the sound of them goes from one end of the world to the other. Evohain, and they are as follows. Two of them we already said. Kol Gaugocham of Kol Hamonish Oroimi. So the sound of the sun's movement and the sound of Hamonish Oroimi. Incidentally, by the way, the Maharal points out, Hamonish Oroimi means the crowds of Rome.
Crowd.
The crowds, yeah. The crowd, the tumult, or whatever of Rome. By the way, the Maharal points out in this connection, we don't necessarily mean the actual physical city of Rome, especially because then you have to ask. So before that city was founded, it was founded only, as we know, in the times of Shlomo HaMelech. So for the 3,000 years before that, what was counteracting the sun? So he says it doesn't mean the actual city of Rome itself. It means the mentality and the idea that Rome represents, which is total being given over to Gashmius.
Chaos.
Not so much chaos, but more
also, yeah.
But more like this world is all there is, and live it up in this world. So that kind of mentality, that kind of philosophy that existed, that kind of clipper that Rome represents existed long before the actual historical city of Rome came into existence. Anyway, so Kol Gaugocham v'Kol Hamonish Oroimi, and the third one, V'Kol Neshama v'Shar Shiyotz Min Aguf. The third one is the sound of the neshama when it leaves the body. That's also something which goes misofa olam v'ad sofa. It travels from one end of the world to the other. Marsha says the symbolism of that means, in other words, that here we're not necessarily talking about a koil as an actual sound. Here we mean the effect of it. The effect and the knowledge of this is spread out throughout the whole world. The Kol Gaugocham, it has a tremendous effect every day on the world that the sun is traveling in any given place from east to west and providing light and heat and so forth. Kol Hamonish Oroimi also is very famous all over the world, that everybody knows that they have this world empire and they're extremely powerful. As far as the neshama, when a person passes away, that also is something that affects the entire world. In the sense, everybody realizes Gaugel Hu Shechoze Ba'olam. It's a wheel, and sooner or later, everybody comes to that point on the wheel. So it's something that affects the entire world.
Romans were destroyed.
So that's the thing. The actual historical Roman Empire was destroyed, but their culture, first of all, the mentality that they had of being against Kedusha and all that still exists. And second of all, we've talked about lots of times, you have lots of aspects of their culture that still inform civilization, Western civilization. Look at the United States, for example. Look at how many of its public buildings are built on the Roman model. Look how much of its government is built on the Roman model. Look at how its national mottos like E Pluribus Unum come from Latin and things like that. So the Romans still have an enormous influence on the world even now.
Judaism
brought monotheism, but you still have the Western civilization is Lahavdo, kind of a combination of Judaism and Romanism. The two of them together make up what we think of as Western civilization. So yeah. So the Yesh Omer Afridia. Some say there's a fourth one that the Yesh Omer Afleda. Some say also birth. In the sense also that when a person is born, that also, the same way as death, we're saying is Gaugelu Shechoz Ba'olam, the same way birth also is something that eventually comes to, that keeps on going all over the world. So in that sense, it's a coil that travels around from one part of the world to the other. The Yesh Omim Af Ridya. Some say also Ridya. Ridya literally means the plower. So it refers to, it actually brings from a Gemara in Tainis, it refers to the Malach, who's in charge of directing the rain where it's supposed to go. Hashem himself has the key of rain. Hashem is the one who decides when it's going to rain and where it's going to rain. But there's a certain Malach by the name of Ridya, whose job is to direct that flow of rain that Hashem has decided on and then direct it to the particular places that need it. He's called Ridya, the plower, because the Gemara tells us in Tainus, he appears in the form of an ox, like an ox that plows. So, So some say that he also, when he accomplishes his job of directing the rain to where it's supposed to go, that is also a sound that's heard me so for Olam Bad so. And again, the symbolism of it is, would be, in other words, because again, that rain is something that affects the entire world. However, we have the third one was the sound of the neshama as it leaves the body. The chachamim daven for rachamim, that shouldn't be, ubatluha, and they will mevatel it. Now, what does that mean? Maharsha says, the fact is, we find many times in the Gemara and in the Midrashim that the Chachamim were able to cancel a gzera of Misa. There was a gzera on an individual person or on a community or whatever that they should suffer Misa, and the Chachamim were able to be mevatel it. In that sense, we're saying the Chachamim have the power to override this kol neshom b'shar sheyotzim aguf. The Maharal, following his shitta before, has a whole explanation differently. He says, I can't really explain it fully. He says, but I'm going to give you a Pesach. I'm going to give you like a Pesach mefulash, like a wide open opening through which you can, based on these few words that I'm going to say, that you can try to understand these Gemaras on a deeper level. And he explains that each of these things is something that you're saying that it has a tremendous effect in particular on the gashmius of the world. So the Gal Gochama provides gashmiistic light and heat for the world. Kol Hamonish Oroimi they stand for the ultimate in enjoyment of gashmius. Neshama B'Shal Sheyotzim and Aguf means that now the neshama is separating from the gashmius of the body. Later is you have a new neshama is coming into the world and being invested in a gashmiistic body. And Ridya is the malach in charge of rain, which also affects the gashmius of the world. So we're saying the chachamim daven for rachmim about the neshama b'shal sheyotzim min haguf to make it that after all the neshama being ruchniistic, it shouldn't be confined in. It shouldn't have to be limited by the limitations of gashmius, and therefore in that sense now it doesn't have a koil hayotza that goes. It doesn't have such a, it's not so enmeshed in Gashmius as it was before. Okay, anyway, the point is that was all a digression, but the point is we were mentioning about Gvini Korah is the announcer in the Beis Mikdash, and we see that bore out Rav's point that the Kriyas HaGever in the Beis Mikdash is a person whose job it is to make the announcements and to tell the Kohenim to be ready for their Avodah. Now, on the other hand, continues the Gemara, Tanya Kavaseh de Rabshila. We learn a Braisa, on the other hand, the way Rabshila understood Kriyas HaGever, that it means when the rooster crows, because a Braisa says, Hayotzel Aderach Kodim Kriyas HaGever. If a person goes out on the road to travel before Kriyas HaGever, Domei Berosha, his blood is on his head. In other words, he himself is responsible for anything bad that happens to him. Rab Yoshiya Ma'ad Shiyishneh. Rav Yoshiya says it's not enough to have one Kriyas HaGever. You need it to do twice. The Yeshem Adchi is Shalish. Others say not until you have three times. And Re'ez a town to go Omru. What kind of rooster are we talking about? So it's clear that this Braisa understands Gever to mean a rooster. Betown to go Benini, the average kind of rooster. You have some kinds are very quick on the draw and they're going to be crowing very early. You have others that are lazier and they'll only crow very late. So we don't have the average one crows at the appropriate time. So then you have, when you have one or two or three times that such roosters crow, then you know it's safe to set out on your trip. Maharshal says, you know, we have at the beginning of Pesachim, we had, and the Gemara mentions in other places that you're supposed to leave, but ki toiv, by Yara Lakima sa'o ki toiv, so you should only leave when there's light in the sky. Well, it's the same thing. In other words, when we're according to these various opinions, once the rooster has crowed once or twice or three times, then you have enough light in the sky that now it's safe to travel. The point is, again, that the Braisa is clearly saying that Kriyas HaGever means the rooster crowing, like Rav Shila said. Okay. Now, the Mishnah had mentioned that on Yom Tovim and then on Yom Kippur, you'd have people would be filling up the Azorah. The Azorah would be very crowded. In the case of Yom Kippur, people are coming to watch the Kohen Gadol's Avodah. In the case of the Regalim, they're coming to bring their Korbanos. So the Mishnah says that even before Kriyas HaGever, the Azorah was already full of Jews. So now let's talk about that. How full was it? Amr of Yehuda, Amr Shmuel, or Rav, different opinion, different Gyosos. Kshahoy Yisrael Oilon L'Regel, when the Jewish people were Oilon L'Regel, when they came on the Shalosh Regalim to the Beis Mikdash, as it says in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Omnim Tzfufim or Mishtachim Meravachim, they would stand very crowded, and then when they bowed down, they would have plenty of room. In particular, Rashi says that, so first of all, tsufim, now the in modern Hebrew, tsufim means crowded. But how does it, what's the shortish of the word? Rashi says the word tsufim comes from the word tsuf, which means floating. It was so crowded that not everybody could even have, that their feet, not everybody's feet are even on the ground. Some people are so crowded among other people that their feet are literally floating off the ground. Anybody who was in 770 back in the day knows exactly what we're talking about over here. So that's the tzvufim. But nevertheless, when it came time to bow down, and in particular, they're going to say vidui, not only there would be plenty of room for them to bow, but also you don't want that one person should hear another person's vidui, because every person is going to be saying vidui for their own individual avedus. So therefore, nes would happen, and there would be four amas space between one person and the next, so that they could say their vidui in private.
Saying the same video after the video, did they go back to being
tzvufim
again?
I guess, yeah, after the video, they went back to being tzvufim. That's what we're saying. It was a nes. But no, when it came to vidui, no, I mean, there is a standard nusach of vidui, but you do have, there's an idea that, first of all, in those times, it wasn't necessarily so formalized like it is now. So everybody might have said their own individual one based on their own individual avedus. Even nowadays, actually, that you have a fixed one in the siddur, it does say, and as some of the posts can talk about, that you, it's appropriate to add your own ones in the appropriate places. You say Malchet, for example, Alchet Shachatan Lefanecha, but Ernest of Rudatsan, Alchet Shachatan Lefanecha, but Imut Salev, for example, if a person knows of himself that he has an Aveda that he did that begins with an Aleph, then let him stick it in over there. And the same thing with each of the other letters of the Aleph days. And he has to verbalize it. And the point is, we don't want that he should have to be embarrassed that other people are going to hear. Maosha points out, really, when you get down to it, I mean, you also have on Yom Kippur, they're also bowing whenever they hear the Kohen Gadol saying the Shem HaMefodesh, like we say in the Avodah on Yom Kippur, Va'akohenim Ba'am, so Shem as Hashem, HaMefodesh Yotzim Pi Kohen Gadol, Hayu Kohenim, and we do Kohenim nowadays also. So of necessity, each person needed four Amos for that alone anyway, because a person's, the length of a person's body is four Amos. So then anyway, they needed four amas per person. But on top of that, we're saying when every person is doing his individual vidui, you also need, there should be space around him so that other people don't hear his vidui and he doesn't get embarrassed. Continues the Braisa, or continues Rabbi Yehuda, v'nim shochim achas esre ama achore beis hakaporis. They'd spread out, because it was so crowded, they would spread out to the 11 amas behind the beis hakaporis. So you have like this, the Azara, the Ezras Yisrael, the Azara, which includes the Ezras Yisrael, you have like this, the Azara, not the Ezras Nashim, but the Azara per se was 187 by 135 Amos. Of that, you had an 11 Amma wide strip that was meant for the Yisraelim. It's called Ezras Yisrael. Then you had another 11 Amma wide strip by the length of it, 135, which is meant for the Kohenim, and it's called Ezras Kohenim. After that, you have the area of the Mizbeach, you have the Beina Ulam Ulam Mizbeach, and then you have the building of the Heichal itself, which is 100 Amas long. And then you have an 11 Amma space behind it. Because it was so crowded, the Ezras Yisrael was only 135 by 11 Amas. So something like 1,500 and some square amas. There wasn't enough room most of the time. So what people would do is, they're not just staying in the Ezras Yisrael, they would also go along the sides of the Azara and go all the way to the area, to the western side of the Azara, behind the Heichal. The idea is, in other words, they're not going to go through the middle of the Azara, because then they'd be in the way of the Kohenim, but they would go along the walls. They'd go along the walls until the back area. And Tani Nami Hochik Shohoyu V'cholo, we learn a Braisa that says the same thing. The question is, my Ko'omer, what does Rabbi Yehuda and the Braisa mean? If Oimnim Tzvufim and Meshtachim and Mervachim, if they have plenty of room when they're bowing the Derech Nes, then why do they need to be behind the Beis HaKaporis? Let them all be in the Ezra Sisrael. The same Nes can happen there. And the Gemara answers, that's exactly what it means. Even though during the whole time they were standing there, it was so crowded that not all of them could fit in the Ezras Yisrael, and necessarily some of them had to go along the sides of the Azara and end up behind the Heichal. Nevertheless, even with all of that, they're standing with such a crush of people that some people don't even have their feet on the floor. Nevertheless, when it came time to bow, then all of a sudden, b'derech nes, they had plenty of room. And in fact, Rashi says what it means is they would actually all be on the east side. They would all be facing the Heichal rather than like this. Some of them are going to be behind the Heichal the whole time, we're saying. But when it came time to bow, they would all be derech nes. They'd be in front of the Heichal in the 11 amos of the Ezri's Yisrael, and yet there would be room enough for all of them to bow and to have four amos around them and so forth. And after that, it would go back to the way it was before. This is, in fact, one of the 10 nisim that regularly took place in the Beis HaMikdash. Zitznan, we learn in a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Asara nisim nasa b'Beis HaMikdash. There were 10 nisim that happened in the Beis HaMikdash. The first one, lahi pila isha mereach b'sara kodesh. No woman ever miscarried from the smell of the meat of the kodshim. Now you have the... You have roasted meat over there. You have meat that's being burnt on the Mizbeach, which itself has quite an aroma. You had meat that's being roasted to be eaten by the Kohenim. And as the Gemara tells us later on in the Masech, that can happen. For example, it can even happen on Yom Kippur, that a woman has a craving for food. And if she doesn't satisfy that craving right away, it could be dangerous for her and the baby. So there was a nest then in that regard that no woman ever had a problem from that and miscarried. So, in fact, Maharal Shah says, now, you did have meat of Kodshim throughout the whole city, because Kodshim Kalim can be eaten throughout the whole city of Yerushalayim. So Maharal Shah says, maybe, in fact, the nest was limited to the Beis HaMikdash itself. Maybe in the rest of Yerushalayim, where you have korbanos that they're able to eat, maybe the nest wasn't necessary. Maybe only in the Beis HaMikdash itself, the parts that are reserved for the Kohenim, or the parts that are being burnt on the Mizbeach. With that said, a lot of other Mephoshim do understand that it means throughout the whole rest of the city. There's actually an interesting sicha where the Rebbe points out, of all things, why is that the first one on the list? And anyway, you have the general question that Rebbe asks, of course, in many sichas on Pirkei Avos. We have a lot of interesting facts that were told in Pirkei Avos, but we know that everything there is mili de chasidusa. The Gemara tells us that everything in Pirkei Avos is meant to teach you how to be a better chosid, how to be a better oivet Hashem. So what do we learn from this list of nisim and the fact that the one about women not miscarrying is first? So we see from that the importance of every Jewish child and then the importance of not thinking, b'derech hateva, I can't have another kid, as we see that Hashem took special steps. And even we put it first on the list that Hashem took special steps to make sure that no Jewish child is miscarried or suffers any injury as a result of the Psara Kodesh. Incidentally, the Rebbe points out, when you think about it, there would have been more reason for women to be affected by it even than the men, including the fact who does most of the cooking is usually the women. So they'd be the ones who'd have more of a craving for it. And yet a nest happened and there was never a problem. Anyway, the second one, the meat of the kodshim never spoiled. Now what are we talking about? So Rashi explains in particular, now you have like this. The meat, let's say, for example, you have all the parts of a korban ola, you have the fats from a korban chatas and osham and most other korbanos. Usually all of those are supposed to be burnt on the day that the korban was brought. But it could happen they didn't have enough time, or there's too many of them. So then the din is, they leave them on top of the Mizbeach overnight. Usually things of Kodshim that are left overnight become possible, but there's a concept called Ein Lina B'Rosh HaShem Mizbeach, that being on top of the Mizbeach, things don't become possible over there. So therefore, they leave them on top of the Mizbeach. And in the morning, then the Kohenim would, after they set up a new wood pile, then they would, they'd burn those pieces over there. So they're laying out there overnight. You might have expected them to spoil, but a nest happened and they never did. Other Mephoshim also point out, the Meiri points out, you also have, for example, meat of Shlomim. The meat of a Shlomim can be eaten for 2 days and the night in between, the Shnei Yomim V'Laila Echad, as well as a couple of other korbanos, Bechor, Meiser. And, you know, without refrigeration, b'derech hateva, they wouldn't be very good the next day, but a nest happened and there was never a problem. Even though it was a hot climate also, yeah. So it never happened that they spoiled. It's Yosef, Anaf Yosef, by the way, brings a fascinating thing over here from Medrash Shmuel, one of the major Mephoshim on Pirkei Avos, who goes systematically through each of these things and shows how each of them helps us in our avodah. Each one of them is a lesson for us in avodah. The first one, for example, about the pregnant women not being endangered by the meat. A person should never think, for example, if I learn Torah, I'm not going to have enough time to take care of my bodily health, and therefore I'm going to become weak. So we tell them, look, Hashem made a nest to prevent that, even though b'derech hateva, the smell of the meat of the kodshim, should cause bodily harm to a pregnant woman and to her baby. Nevertheless, Hashem prevented that from happening. Hashem can do the same for you, that you don't think that you're learning Torah is going to weaken your body. The second one, for example, the Yisriach B'Sar Kodesh Ma'olam, you think of it, for example, what makes the difference? What makes this thing a korban? Only because somebody said verbally, this animal is a korban. And that gives it, that makes it a whole new metzios that now it's not going to spoil. So how much more so than a person acts in a way of chassidus and kedusha, how much more so that he can be sure that that there won't be any spoilage in connection with his body after 120 and even during his lifetime and so forth.
I thought I heard someone that the learning Torah does weaken the body.
But a person shouldn't be worried about that it's going to weaken him in a way that's going to impair his health. It weakens in the sense, for example, we have, let's say, with Rish Lakish, that now he's not this powerful bandit that he was before. He still has tremendous strength, but not quite as much. Because you do have the expression in the Zohar, Chukfa Degufa Cholsha Nishmasa. The stronger the body, the weaker the neshama. So there is a certain weakening of the body that goes together with learning Torah, but the point is, the Medrash Shmuel is saying that don't think it's the kind that's going to impair your health the same way as Hashem could protect the pregnant women, the same way Hashem can protect your health.
Does that go the reverse also? The weaker the body, the stronger Hashem?
Or that, I don't know, maybe. anyway. The third nest was that there were never any flies seen in the Beis HaMetbachayim. The Beis HaMetbachayim is the area of the Azara, where they're skinning and cutting up the animals of the Korbanos. You have the meat and blood and guts and everything all over the place over there, and you would expect flies to be there, but a nest happened and there never were. And Marshall points out, there's a Gemara in Gittin that mentions a fly as something particularly disgusting. So therefore, there was a nest that there were no such things in the Beis HaMetbachayim. The next one, V'le'ira keri l'koyin gadol b'yom kippurim. The next one is the Kohen Gadol never suffered an emission of keri on Yom Kippur. Now, other kinds of traumas can happen. We have examples in various places in our Masechta where the Kohen Gadol could become tummy with some other kind of trauma and have to be replaced by the Sgan. But keri in particular is a particularly repulsive thing, Rashi says, because it comes out of his own body, and therefore there was a special mess that shouldn't happen. Now, the fact is, we did learn before, they took a lot of precautions to prevent that from happening. So that's because Ein Soim Chan Ala Nes. Nevertheless, we're still calling it a Nes, in the sense Eitz Yosef brings from Tosfos Yomtiv, because we know whenever Kedusha is stronger, then Tumah also tries to be correspondingly stronger. So therefore, on Yom Kippur, especially the Koyches HaTumah are going to try to get the Kohen Gadol, and therefore it was a Nes that despite all the they had the precautions, but even the precautions wouldn't have been enough for all of that, and nevertheless, so therefore there had to be a Nes that he would never become a Baal Keri. He'd have to be. I mean, otherwise he's chayav misa b'dei shemayim for doing the avodah tameh. But besides, with that said, though, we did learn before that there was a difference in that regard between the first and second batei mikdash. In the first batei mikdash, they didn't even need to take precautions. In the second batei mikdash, they did. Anyway, the next one is v'lanimsa pisul ba'omer. They never found something possible, for example, that it became tameh with the korban ha'omer. Now, the reason why that nest was needed is because the korban ha'omer, when do they harvest the barley for it? The night before. And then they bring it on the day of the 16th of Nisan, the second day of Pesach. If it became tomei or otherwise possible, they might not have the opportunity to bring another one. And then there'd be no korban ha'omer that year. Because after all, it takes, they only harvested just about as much as they needed for the korban ha'omer. They didn't harvest a lot extra. Then they had to sift it, and they had to grind it, and they had the whole processing of it took time. And now, if it became possible, then they would have to start that all over again, and there wouldn't necessarily be time to do it. Tosfos Yeshanim actually points out, the fact is, earlier in the Perek, the Gemara mentions, it wasn't in Ein Yaakov, but it mentions in the Gemara, that sometimes it would happen, they did have a substitute Korban Omer available, but nevertheless, it wasn't common. Most of the time, they did not have one available. So therefore, there was a special nest that it never became possible. The next one, over Shtei Alechem, same thing with the Shtei Alechem for Shavuos, those even more so, those have to be baked before Yom Tov. You're not, at least the Omer is brought on Chol HaMoed, so if need be, you can harvest more. But the Shtei Alechem had to be baked before Yom Tov. They're only offered on Yom Tov. So if they became possible, if they became Tomei or broke or whatever, you wouldn't be able to bake new ones on Yom Tov. And then you wouldn't have a Shtei Alechem that year. And with Lechem Aponim, and similarly with Lechem Aponim, same thing. Those have to be placed on the Shulchan on Shabbos. And again, they can't be baked on Shabbos. They have to be baked before Shabbos. So if they became possible in any way, then the Shulchan would be without Lechem Aponim for an entire week, because the only time you can put it on there is on Shabbos. So therefore, there was a nest that none of those things never happened. Okay, we'll continue with this list tomorrow, Beis Hashem. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ola, Chof Beis Chetven. We started talking about yesterday, the Rebbe talked about the simonim of what it says at the end of Sota about the seemingly negative things that are going to happen before Mashiach comes. There's chutz v'yaske, and people are going to be insulting their elders and so on and so forth. And the Rebbe was talking about there is a mal yuse in it. He said that a person is going to have the chutzpah to go far beyond what he normally thinks he could in avodah, and then go and teach and be mashpia on other people, even if he thinks he doesn't have the possibility, even if b'derech hateva he doesn't have the ability to do that. You have a person who's a zokin in Torah, but he's new to Torah sachsidus. He'll be willing to suffer the embarrassment of being a nar, of being a youth, a beginner in pnimiyas haTorah. So now, continuing on that topic, we said another thing was that it mentioned over there, a daughter will rise up against her mother. So what does that mean in Avoda? Even within a person's household. Now you have that there were things where maybe in a certain family, they were mako and such things. And sometimes maybe there was a valid reason. Previously, they were going through hard times. They couldn't be machmu. They couldn't be so mahadur in a mitzvah. So now what happens is the daughter stands up against her mother or against her mother-in-law and says, no, we're not cutting corners. We're doing things with the greatest possible hiddur. And that eventually causes that the mothers and the mothers-in-law follow suit and accept those hidurim and accept those chumras as well. So that's the mal yusa of the daughter standing up against her mother and her mother-in-law and saying it's not enough that we've been doing things by half measures until now. Now we're going to do it completely the right way.
What does mal yusa mean?
The mal yusa means for the good, in the positive way. Okay. Continuing with halachas, we were talking about the halachas of traveling on a ship before Shabbos. So we said you're not allowed to leave any time after Wednesday. It has to be a goyish of one ship. And if it's on the other hand, a riverboat, you can go even on Erev Shabbos, etc. Now, what happens if you in cases where you're allowed to go on a boat on Shabbos? So then what happens is if suppose the boat is going to be leaving Erev Shabbos, what you do is you go onto the boat before Shabbos, you wait there until Shabbos begins. That way you're koina shvisa on the boat. Then even though you're going back home and sleeping there overnight, you would be allowed to then board the ship on Shabbos, as long as, again, the ship is not going only for Jews. Because once, if the ship docks on Shabbos, then you're outside your tchum because you were kona shvisa in your house. Therefore, you only have four amos in the place where you dock. But at least on board the ship, you would be able. In short, you're allowed to board the ship on Shabbos as long as you were on it at the beginning of Shabbos until it got dark, because then it's considered that you made that your place for Shabbos. Kona shvisa means that you acquired. This is your resting place for Shabbos is on board the boat. Okay.